Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 194. It's Monday, January 16th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's do a brief COVID plus report. The good news is that in the viral soup we've been living in this winter, flu and RSV are coming down. COVID hospitalizations, thank goodness, have also been in decline. The flu, RSV, and COVID season is far from over. The XBB.1.5 variant is still moving across the U.S., and this should continue well into February. COVID deaths are the highest they've been since last winter's Omicron surge. Even though we had a pretty good burn this whole summer, last summer, and we're now averaging over 500 deaths per day. Fortunately, this is far below the 3,000 plus deaths per day that we had last winter, but it's the worst we've had in the last year. And finally got access to nursing home data. There's been a problem with the Ohio Department of website where it wasn't accessible. So I haven't reported that in the last 5 weeks. Unfortunately, there were 111 active cases in long-term care facilities in Lucas County. 70 residents and 41 staff have COVID currently. And this is the highest number since the worst 4 weeks of Omicron last winter. Probably a good example of the fact that with a highly transmissible variant still out there, that vulnerable populations are still vulnerable. Take care, folks. Get the updated booster if you haven't gotten it. Wear good quality masks in indoor public places. And it's not even too late to get a flu shot. Okay, well, while COVID isn't as bad as it was last winter or the winter before, particularly with the early and higher RSV and flu epidemics this viral season this winter, we are seeing, like in wintertime normally, pre-pandemic has been a tough time for hospitals because of infectious viral diseases. Well, COVID hasn't made any better, and unfortunately, our healthcare system has been taxed, so it's getting even worse. So, this from the Washington Post. The doctor won't see you now. COVID winters are making long hospital waits the new normal. As the United States enters its third full COVID winter, a top administration official is warning that the permanence of the coronavirus in the disease landscape could mean brutal and long-lasting seasonal surges of cold weather illnesses for years to come, resulting in hospitals struggling to care for non-COVID emergencies and unable to give patients timely, life-saving treatments. Winter has traditionally been crunch time for hospitals because of influenza and another seasonal pathogen, respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV. Now SARS-CoV-2 has joined them to form an unholy trinity of pathogens that surge in the cold months. White House COVID-19 response coordinator Ashish Jha said the American healthcare system may not be able to withstand the continued viral onslaught, straining the system's ability to care for other serious illnesses. I am worried that we are going to have for years our health system being pretty dysfunctional, not being able to take care of heart attack patients, not being able to take care of cancer patients, not being able to take care of the kid who gets appendicitis because we're going to be so overwhelmed with respiratory viruses for 3 or 4 months a year, Ja told the Post. He described a scenario in which the typical winter logjam of patients begins much earlier than usual, in August or September, because of the coronavirus. It's a darker scenario than the administration has portrayed in the past, and one Ja said most Americans have yet to realize. I just think people have not appreciated the chronic cost because we have seen this as an acute problem, Ja said. We have no idea how hard this is going to make life for everybody for long periods of times. James Jarvis, a senior executive at Bangor-based Northern Light Health, the second largest health system in Maine, shares Ja's concerns. He said hospitals now expect to see patients who are sicker, including people with long COVID, children more at risk for diabetes because of COVID-19 infections, and patients suffering from heart conditions related to previous bouts of the disease. These warnings come at a moment when public health officials are still waiting to see how bad the current winter surge in viral infections turns out to be. So far, this COVID winter in the United States has been challenging, though not nearly as disastrous as the past two. But most of the winter still lies ahead, and COVID-19 hospitalizations have risen significantly since October. Ja told the Post that he compares the healthcare system to a seawall, holding back a certain level of water. In winter, when case numbers pile up, the water splashes over a little. Hospitals staff up temporarily and try to make it through until the water recedes. That's the old normal. But SARS-CoV-2 has dumped new water in that sea, and the flood of patients has cascading effects on other types of medical care. Ann Zink, chief medical officer for the Alaska Department of Health, said Ja's seawall analogy accurately describes the stress of the pandemic on America's overall declining health. The seawall was crumbling before the pandemic, and the waves of the pandemic created great holes, and that continual onslaught will degrade the wall and make it worse, said Zink, an emergency room physician who is also president of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. In addition, uncertainties in the medical supply chain have become the new normal, said Jarvis. Medication and supply shortages happen with greater frequency. Critical shortages for nurses and other staff are expected to worsen as physicians and nurses retire but aren't replaced in the same numbers. Before the pandemic, the hospital system had always had some flexibility and had been able to manage its shortage of acute care beds, Jarvis said. But that flexibility is now gone, he said. There is no wiggle room or expansion room that would have for anything in reserve. Since the start of the pandemic, experts have warned that COVID-19 is not the only killer when healthcare systems are under stress. People with ailments may delay tests and screening. They may be more reluctant to go to the hospital for fear of catching an infection. And patients may wind up waiting hours for an examination when minutes count. Delays of care will result in people having either more severe disease or, unfortunately, dying. And there's little that we can do to prevent that, Jarvis said. You know, that has always happened, but never to the extent that it is happening now. As for the future, it's only going to get worse, Jarvis said. Hospitals are already under financial stress because of rising labor costs, physician burnout, and the trend towards outpatient treatment. The added coronavirus strain is likely to push some facilities over the edge, noted Robert Wachter, a professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. With all this, you'll see hospitals beginning to close at a faster pace, leaving some rural and suburban communities without a hospital, and fewer hospitals in urban areas. So far, Congress and the federal government broadly have not taken concerted action to address these chronic challenges. There is no cavalry on the horizon for the healthcare system. And next up from CBS News, an interesting story on the ongoing impacts of the pandemic. Law enforcement officers' deaths due to COVID fell by 83% in 22. That's good news. In 2022, 226 law enforcement officers died in the line of duty, according to preliminary data compiled by the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, showing a significant drop over 2021. And much of the decrease is attributed to a dramatic reduction in deaths from COVID-19. Last year, 70 law enforcement officers died in the line of duty as a result of contracting COVID-19, an 83% drop compared to the 405 officers killed in 2021. Despite these steep reductions, COVID-19 remains the number one cause of law enforcement deaths in 2022. Okay, just want to say that. So we have a great news that there's an 83% reduction, but it has hardly gone away. I mean, police officers tend to be relatively young. Hopefully you're at least as healthy as the average population. That may be debatable. But COVID remains the number one cause of law enforcement deaths in 2022. Now, as we listen to the story, there may be another one competing that they're not accounting for adequately, but let's continue. In total, 226 law enforcement officers died in the line of duty in 2021, according to data surveying federal, state, tribal, and local law enforcement, and released last Wednesday. Of those, 64 officers were shot and killed in the line of duty in 2022, the same number killed by firearms in 2021. You'll notice that's less than the people that died of COVID. Currently, the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund does not include in the statistics officers who died by suicide, despite mounting evidence of work-related PTSD among law enforcement. For its part, the FBI began collecting information last year for a new database intending to track the growing suicide rate within the nation's law enforcement ranks. In November, President Biden signed into law the Public Safety Officer Support Act, expanding death and disability benefits to include law enforcement who die by suicide who are disabled by traumatic experiences. According to the nonprofit organization Blue Help, 180 officers died by suicide in 2022. And while the National Law Enforcement Officer Memorial Fund supports the law's passage, the organization has not yet added the names of officers who have died by suicide to its memorial. Our stringent review process is probably stricter than any other organization in the country, and we do not include suicides as a line-of-duty deaths. With that being said, we are looking at the newly signed legislation, and we are having conversations around it. So, just to sum up, suicide kills way more people than people that are than officers that are actually shot in the line of duty, and even COVID-19 kills more officers from documented transmissions happening in the line of duty. Of course, police officers have a lot of public contact and a lot of physical contact with folks in the public, so they're particularly susceptible as kind of first line responders to COVID. And, of course, we've known for a long time that for many, many years, law enforcement, even military folks in combat situations, are actually more likely to die at their own hands by suicide than they are by enemy fire. Okay, next up, another story that also gets to the long-term impacts of the pandemic. This from Reuters. U.S. childhood vaccinations dip again in 2021 and 2022 school years, says study. Vaccination rates among kindergarten children against potentially deadly diseases such as polio, measles, and diphtheria fell in the 2021-2022 school year, extending the previous year's slide from pre-pandemic levels, a U.S. government study showed released last Thursday. The fall in rates for the four most commonly required childhood vaccines reflects a disruption caused by COVID-19 on healthcare and the need to restore vaccination coverage to pre-pandemic levels, the CDC said of the data it collected. We're still trying to understand the extent to which misinformation around COVID vaccine has spread to misinformation about other childhood vaccines, said Sean O'Leary, the American Academy of Pediatrics chair of the Committee of Infectious Diseases, said. Overall, those receiving state-required vaccinations declined to about 93% last year, down from 94% in the previous school year and 95% in the 2019 to 2020 school year, according to the CDC report. When you're talking about these either really large percents or really small percents, sometimes it's good to inverse them. And if you look at that, is basically a couple years ago, you had 5% of the people that are unvaccinated, of these kindergartners, for these particular diseases. And that's increased from 5% to 7%. So it looks a little bit more when you look at that way as a proportional increase. And getting at the actual numbers, with a vaccination rate of 93.5% specifically against measles, below the national target of 95%, roughly 250,000 kindergarten-age kids were potentially unprotected against the disease, CDC said. All U.S. states require the vaccine against measles and rubella, and all but Iowa requires the shots against mumps. All states also require the combined diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis shot, and the vaccine against poliovirus, while 49 states require inoculation against chickenpox. Exemptions for vaccinations, which may be granted by states in cases where parents request them for the children, remain low at 2.6%. However, an additional 3.9% who had never requested exemptions were not up to date with the measles, mumps, and rubella shot. That's the MMR shot. And again, so the majority of people that are not getting vaccinated, it's not specifically because they're claiming some kind of exemption. They're just being missed for other reasons. The study authors, which included researchers from the CDC, said it had several limitations due to variations in state guidelines and data collection methods that may miss certain children, such as those that are homeschooled. O'Leary said the data points to U.S. need for a focus on addressing access and poverty in order to increase vaccination rates. Okay, next up from Reuters, we have some good news, bad news. U.S. says traffic deaths fell slightly for the first 9 months of 2022. U.S. traffic deaths fell 0.2% in the first 9 months of 2022, reversing a sharp rise in the two prior pandemic years when speeding and other unsafe behavior increased, regulators said. U.S. traffic deaths jumped 10.5% in 2021 to almost 43,000, the largest number killed on American roads in a year since 2005, after rising 7% in 2020. The traffic fatality rate through September is still higher than any pre-pandemic year since 2007. So that's the bad news of the good news. It seems that it's leveled off or declined a bit, but still at a very high level, the highest we've seen since 2007. Despite the slight overall decline in 2022, the number of pedestrians and bicyclists killed on U.S. roads is still rising. In 2021, pedestrians killed increased 13%. To over 7,300, the most since 1981. The number of cyclists killed rose 5% to almost 1,000, the most since at least 1980. In the first 6 months of 2022, U.S. pedestrian deaths rose another 2% and bicyclist deaths jumped another 8%. The Governor's Highway Safety Association said the unacceptably high death toll underscores the urgent need to ensure that road users outside vehicles enjoy the same protections as drivers and passengers. And as a frequent biker, I'll say hear, hear to that. Okay, well, let's move on to a series of healthcare stories, and after that, we'll get on to a series of environmental stories. So first up, this from The Hill. Sanders tells Moderna planned COVID vaccine price hike is unacceptable corporate greed. Senator Bernie Sanders is calling on Moderna not to quadruple the price of its COVID vaccine, saying last Tuesday that the plan amounts to, quote, unacceptable corporate greed. In a letter sent to Moderna CEO Stephanie Bancel, Sanders urged the company to reconsider its decision and refrain from any price increase, quote, in light of the role the federal government has played in the development of the vaccine. Sanders, the incoming chairman of the Senate Health Committee, said the company's decision to charge up to $130 a dose once the shots move to the commercial marketplace is, quote, outrageous and will cost taxpayers billions of dollars. As you know, the federal government over the years has supported Moderna every step of the way, going back to 2013 when your company reportedly only had 3 employees. Now, in the midst of a continuing public health crisis and a growing federal deficit, is not the time for Moderna to be quadrupling the price of its vaccine, he wrote. Now is not the time for unacceptable corporate greed. I'm not sure when the time would be for unacceptable corporate greed, but it certainly is not now. I find your decision particularly offensive given the fact that the vaccine was jointly developed in partnership with scientists from the National Institute of Health, a U.S. government agency that is funded by U.S. taxpayers, Sanders wrote, adding that the government invested $1.7 billion into the company for vaccine research and development. Let's be clear, the purpose of the recent taxpayer investment in Moderna was to protect the health and lives of the American people, not to turn a handful of corporate executives and investors into multi-billionaires, he said. As the new chairman of the Senate's Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, Sanders is expected to focus on the cost of prescription drugs, among other priorities. While most progressive policies won't get traction in the GOP-controlled House, Sanders will still be able to call hearings and cause headaches for industry executives.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? from endemic racism that nobody seems to see, try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Well, next up, a story that accentuates the fact that healthcare is not very healthy in a lot of workplaces, put both employees and patients at risk. This from Associated Press. Even as New York nurses return to work, more strikes could follow. Even as 7,000 nurses return to work at two of New York's busiest hospitals after a three-day strike, colleagues around the country say it's just a matter of time before frontline workers at other hospitals begin walking the picket line. Problems are mounting at hospitals across the nation as they try to deal with widespread staffing shortages, overworked nurses beaten down by the pandemic, and a busted pipeline of new nurses. That's led to nurses juggling dangerously high caseloads, said Michelle Collins, dean at the College of Nursing and Health at Loyola University in New Orleans. There's no place that's immune from what's happening with the nursing shortage, Collins said. It's everywhere. Union leaders say the tentative contract agreement ending the strike by nurses at Mount Sinai and Montefiore Medical Center, each privately owned nonprofit hospitals that hold over 1,000 beds in New York City, will relieve chronic short staffing and boost pay by 19% over 3 years. Last year, six unions representing a total of 32,000 nurses launched strikes outside of hospital systems around the country, according to the Bureau of Labor and Statistics. Those strikes represent about a quarter of all the major strikes in the U.S. last year, an increase from the year before. Describing hospital environments where nurses are unable to take breaks because they're assigned too many patients, some of whom are pleading for care from frontline workers, the president of the American Nurses Association, Dr. Jennifer Mensah Kennedy, said some nurses may think their only option is to strike. Okay, next up, are you ready for an awards presentation? This from MedPage Today. Medicare Advantage plans take top spot in Shkreli Awards. Medicare Advantage plans took the top spot in this year's Shkreli Awards, the annual list from the Loan Institute that calls attention to some of healthcare's most greedy and unethical behavior. The plan's penchant for defrauding or overbilling Medicare by an estimated $25 billion in 2020 alone, by saying beneficiaries were much sicker than they actually were, earned them their top marks, according to the Loan Institute. The annual ranking is named after pharma executive Martin Shkreli, who raised the price of life-saving drugs for AIDS patients from $13.50 to $750 per pill, and who was sentenced in 2018 to 7 years in prison for securities fraud. Patient activists, health policy experts, and journalists were among the judges. Loan Institute President Vika Sayani told MedPage Today that this year's list reads like a tragic comedy of grift and profiteering. If the actions of these companies and individuals seem to be worse than in past years, Sayani said, that's because governmental agencies and media organizations appear to be more vigilant in calling out bad actors. Medicare Advantage companies were selected as the worst offenders because the prevalence of fraud was so overwhelming, it struck a chord with our judges. It was pretty prevalent in that 9 out of 10 insurers in terms of market share were among those names. So it's not just one or two bad actors, Sandy said. If anything, it is their business model, a pervasive and systemic problem with immense costs that in my view really represents foregone opportunities to make us all healthier. The winners are of the awards. Of course, we're the losers at the hands of those award winners. We'll start, I guess we'll do it, we probably should do a countdown from 10. Why don't we do that? We'll start with 10 and go back down to number 1 here. Let me get to 10 here. Starting with number 10, Wisconsin dentist Scott Charmoli went from fixing 434 crowns a year to 1,000 by breaking patients' teeth starting in 2015. He intentionally broke through their teeth with his drill in order to convince the insurance companies to pay for the crowns. In March 2022, a jury found him guilty of 5 counts of healthcare fraud and 2 counts of making false statements to insurance companies. He was sentenced to 54 months in prison and ordered to pay more than $1 million in fines. Now, you kind of wonder, don't you think that would be a physical assault for intentionally breaking people's teeth? Yikes, you did that out in the street. You'd be in jail for the rest of your life. And that only came into 10th place. Number 9. Catholic Medical Center of Manchester, New Hampshire, continued to let cardiac surgeon Yvonne Barbeau operate on patients despite knowing his high number of malpractice case settlements, including involving some 14 patient deaths. Yet the hospital system continued to support him and promote him in ads. His malpractice record is said to be among the worst in the country. Coming in number 8. 3 North Texas laboratories got $300 million more for Medicare by bribing physicians to order unnecessary drug tests and blood work. The founders of the 3 labs pleaded guilty to fraud in April of last year. Coming in number 7, rather than counsel low-income patients on financial assistance programs that they might be entitled to, Washington state-based Providence Healthcare System instead hounded them to pay and sent debt collectors after them when they didn't. The Rev Up campaign, developed with help from corporate consultant McKinsey, directed employees to inform patients about financial assistance programs only as a last resort. More than 55,000 patients were pursued by debt collectors when they should have been offered a discount. Providence told New York Times reporters that they stopped the practice and will issue refunds to about 760 patients. Yeah, big freaking deal. In 6th place, tobacco company Philip Morris has spent 175 years selling cigarettes known to cause heart disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and other health problems. According to Stat News, it now is reaping profits by acquiring companies that make inhaled therapeutics that treat the conditions cigarettes cause. The Loan Institute said that experts have concerns a company could use research on these inhalation therapies to hook even more people on their products. Oh my goodness. And coming in 5th place, Johnson & Johnson sold talc baby powder products for years knowing that they contained asbestos, a deadly carcinogen. Now faced with lawsuits from 40,000 cancer patients, many of them black women to whom J&J marketed its powdered products. The company created a subsidiary with all the baby powder-related liabilities. Then it declared the company bankrupt. It ranked in the top 50 of Fortune's largest companies last year. In 4th place, leaders of Novus Hospice in Frisco, Texas, provided their employees and pre-signed prescription pads with directions to give patients morphine and hydrocodone without guidance or oversight from physicians. CEO Bradley Harris instructed employees to give higher doses of the painkillers to hasten patient death. The goal was to avoid longer lengths of stay that would result in a cap on government reimbursement to the hospice. According to the FBI, Harris sent an employee a text message saying, "You need to make this patient go bye-bye." The Loan Institute said it was unclear whether any patients were actually overdosed or died because of Harris's instructions. And in 3rd place, safety net hospitals that have a disproportionate share of low-income patients benefit from the federal 340B program, which provides hefty discounts on medications. But Richmond Community Hospital in the Bon Secours Health System profited from this program even though it lacks an ICU, maternity ward, or even a consistently working MRI machine. It diverted profits incurred by Richmond to its other hospitals in wealthier, whiter neighborhoods, basically laundering money through this poor hospital to its wealthy outposts, according to a former Richmond ER doctor. And in 2nd place, private equity-backed startup Noble Health bought 2 rural Missouri hospitals, then left employees with drug and supply shortages that led to unsafe conditions for patients. Nobel also stopped paying for employees' health insurance, despite deducting premium payments from their paychecks. Then Nobel closed the 2 hospitals after taking $20 million in COVID relief funds. Oh, gag me. And number 1. Most large Medicare Advantage insurers now face federal accusations that they have been defrauding the Medicare program by mining patients' charts for diagnoses that have been resolved or which they never had, or exaggerating their severity. The amount of overpayment is estimated at $25 billion in 2020 alone, according to the New York Times investigation and numerous other investigations by the Office of Inspector General. The huge amount of overpayments has raised questions about continued federal payment policies to these companies and the health of the Medicare Trust Fund. Yikes. Well, you are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, and another stinking example of how Medicare Advantage plans don't work well, this from Roll Call. Providers say Medicare Advantage hinders new methadone benefit. In 2018, responding to a wave of overdose deaths, Congress passed legislation requiring Medicare to pay for services at opioid treatment programs for the first time. But 2 years after Medicare began covering those programs, which use methadone and other medications to help reduce opioid use and overdose deaths, providers say their efforts are being hindered by Medicare Advantage, private insurance companies that administer benefits to about half of the Medicare population. They say the tactics Medicare Advantage has long used to control healthcare costs can also delay or block access to patient care, which can be especially dangerous or deadly for someone with a substance use disorder. Once a patient reaches out for treatment, they're not going to sit around and wait. If you don't get people into treatment that day, you've kind of lost them to the street, and that's what is most concerning, said Jay Higham, CEO of Behavioral Health Group, which operates 120 opioid treatment programs in 24 states. Opioid treatment programs say they usually must first get approval from Medicare Advantage plans for their services to be paid for, a process that can take several days or weeks. Patients have been told they must pay for a portion of their care and get referrals from primary care doctors before starting treatment. Programs also say Medicare Advantage plans are slow to issue payments, if they pay at all, and also make it difficult to get on a list of covered providers called a network. Such obstacles have led some opioid treatment programs to be more selective about which Advantage plans they work with. It's basically a benefit without being a benefit, said Gary Houle, CEO of the North Charles Mental Health Research and Training Foundation, a nonprofit that operates an opioid treatment program in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They say they provide reimbursement for methadone treatment, but they really don't. There's so many roadblocks, it's impossible. He said his program has had to stop accepting some Medicare Advantage plans because of non-payments or difficult prior authorization practices. The opioid crisis remains acute. A record high 80,000 people died of opioid overdoses in 2021, a 15% increase over 2020. There are about 1,900 opioid treatment programs in the United States. While some lawmakers and addiction experts have called for making methadone available outside of opioid treatment programs, for now, those programs are the only outpatient settings that can dispense methadone, which has been shown to reduce opioid use and overdose deaths and curb withdrawal symptoms. Advantage plans, also known as Medicare Part C, were established in 1997 to administer Medicare benefits at supposedly lower cost than the government. But the tactics that they argue reduce unnecessary care and lower health costs, like prior authorization, have been criticized across the board by physicians and providers, including opioid treatment programs. It's really an important issue to make sure that people have immediate access to treatment. As soon as you put prior authorization on it, you're delaying that access, said Allegra Shore, president of the Coalition of Medicaid-Assisted Treatment Providers and Advocates of New York, which represents 108 opioid treatment programs in the state. Under federal regulations, Medicare Advantage plans can take up to 72 hours to respond to an urgent request or up to 14 days for a non-urgent request. But that is time wasted when someone with opioid use disorder needs to begin treatment. Sometimes those requests are denied with no explanation, or providers must resubmit requests after a few months of treatment. Short said she is also increasingly seeing plans require physician referrals for opioid treatment programs, which can also lead to delays, especially if someone doesn't already have a primary care provider, which is often the case. If a person is in withdrawal and can't get treatment, they might return to illicit drugs and overdose, said Shore, who is also vice president of West Midtown Medical Group, an opioid treatment program in New York City. In 2022, 85% of Medicare Advantage enrollees were in plans that require prior authorization for coverage of opioid treatment programs, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation analysis. Some plans don't make clear when prior authorization is necessary, leaving providers to find out what is when they don't get paid for a service or their claims are denied. Other opioid treatment programs say their claims for payment are often denied without reason. North Child's Mental Health Research and Training Foundation has had to rely on seeking payments for treating some Advantage enrollees through a state program that reimburses care for uninsured or underinsured patients. It's a barrier to care is what it is. They're never going to admit it's intentional, but it sure does seem like that, Hole said. If we're out to save lives and treat people as quickly as we can when they present themselves, these advantage plans are not helpful. David Kinesi, regional director of the Central Florida Treatment Center, said there is little or no guidance from Medicare Advantage plans about how to get in network, whether they require prior authorization, and what documentation and billing codes they do need. It's not like they go, congratulations, you're now in a network with the United Healthcare Medicare Advantage plan. Let us walk you through how to bill. It's a crapshoot. You just start processing through denials and changing things, and they won't tell you how to fix them, Kinesi said. You keep trying and applying and submitting and getting denied and changing things one piece at a time until you find the magic formula that actually works. And some of them just don't work. They just don't pay. All these hoops take time to jump through, during which Central Florida Treatment Centers tries to continue seeing patients with Medicare Advantage plans. We do everything we can to work with the patient, but there comes a point we can't treat multiple people for free. Many Medicare Advantage programs require patients to pay for a portion of their own treatment called a copay. Studies have long shown copays can be a barrier to care. If a plan imposes a copay every time they show up, that's completely unreasonable, said Jason Clutter, president of Baymark Health Services, which has 116 opioid treatment programs in 37 states. Patients typically must visit opioid treatment points several times a week for treatment, even if it's just $5. If you've got to do that 30 days a month, it's unreasonable. Traditional Medicare doesn't require copays for opioid treatment program services, noting in a 2020 rule that it wanted to minimize barriers to patient access to treatment services. But Advantage plans are allowed by law to set copays with the intention of reducing healthcare costs by making patients reconsider whether they need a service or doctor's visit. The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services is proposing that Advantage plans use Medicare coverage rules when determining whether a request is medically necessary. Currently, plans can create their own rules for making prior authorization decisions, and those criteria are often shielded from the public. A report released in April by the Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General found that of prior authorization requests denied by Medicare Advantage plans, 13% were for services that would have been covered by traditional Medicare. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services also wants to require that prior authorization approvals be valid for the duration of the course of treatment and for plans to clearly state when prior authorization is necessary. Plans would have to state any needed documentation for those requests and explain their reason for any denials to providers and patients. The agency has not proposed changing the 72-hour timeline for urgent requests. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is also proposing prohibiting misleading marketing around Medicare Advantage that experts say has contributed to increased enrollment in these plans. When evaluating whether a plan's network is adequate, the center also wants to start considering whether there are enough opioid treatment programs available and whether they are accessible to enrollees. The Medicare Rights Center, American Center of Addiction Medicine, National Association of Behavioral Healthcare, and others have called on the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to update network adequacy requirements to address substance use-specific facilities like opioid treatment programs and provide better oversight of Advantage plans. We're very concerned that when people ask for care and they are denied, this is a terrible outcome that can be life-changing or life-ending decision for that person, said Julie Carter. Federal Policy Associate for the Medicare Rights Center. Things may get really out of control after that point, and we want to make sure people get the care they need in the moment they are able to. This is another case of all the more reason to get everybody in, nobody out, integrated health care for all plan for the United States of America.
It started in Norway in 1912. And they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure health care for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up, some evidence that expanding Medicaid is helpful. This from The Hill. Medicaid expansion linked with fewer postpartum hospitalizations. States that expanded Medicaid after the Affordable Care Act saw a 70% drop in hospitalizations among women during the first 60 days postpartum, new research shows. Medicaid expansion permitted states to cover most adults with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level, allowing a larger share of low-income individuals to qualify for coverage before pregnancy and after a 60-day postpartum period. This preconception and postpartum insurance coverage among low-income birthing people led to greater continuity of coverage and use of outpatient care. Access to health care during pregnancy and the postpartum period are crucial for both new parents and their infants. However, in the United States, lack of insurance coverage can prevent many mothers from seeking care and lead to worse health outcomes. Compared with 10 other developed countries, the United States ranks worst when it comes to maternal mortality, while data show more than half of maternal deaths occur in the postpartum period. The United States is the only developed country that does not guarantee access to provider home visits or paid maternal leave during this period, according to the Commonwealth Fund. Okay, well, next I want to switch to some environmental stories, and it's an interesting contrast when you're looking at, like, the environment, say, versus healthcare. This is a fact sheet put out by the Health Policy Institute of Ohio, a closer look at outdoor air pollution and health. It has measures of outdoor air quality, and Ohio is ranked 46th on outdoor air quality among states, meaning that most other states have cleaner outdoor air. And of course, as I've reported much in the past, improving outdoor air quality will lead to better maternal infant health, less chronic diseases, and other improved outcomes for Ohioans. And an interesting thing that they have in this little fact sheet is they look at the strength of relationship between various domains and health. Population health, health of the entire population, which is what, of course, public health is about. And actually, there's only a weak correlation between access to care and only a moderate correlation between your healthcare system. Because Ohio as a state actually ranks pretty well as far as healthcare resources, you know, the amount of healthcare that we have, but that's only moderately correlated with population health. And what are the two things that they list here that are most strongly associated with population health? Not surprisingly, public health and prevention and physical environment. And after that, a much larger than a healthcare system, but also moderately strong relationship is social and economic environment. So again, we have to look at these social determinants of health in many cases to really look at how to improve the health of a population, not simply getting more and more healthcare. And a couple stories on how environment affects health. This is from Axios. Drought and extreme rains linked to infectious disease in kids. A new study finds that drought and flood-causing rains are linked to increases in deadly diarrhea-related illnesses for young children in the global south. This further demonstrates the role of climate-related impacts on the inequitable burden of disease. They found evidence that periods with heavy precipitation events and droughts correlated with reported symptoms of diarrhea for children under the age of 3, one of the leading causes of child mortality worldwide. During extreme rains or droughts, there's an increase in the rates of risk for diarrheal infection, putting malnourished children in harm's way to an even greater degree, according to the lead author Anna Dimitrova, a postdoctoral researcher at UC San Diego Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Droughts can lead people to consume water from unsafe sources and to reduce their hygiene practices, while heavy rains can lead to the contamination of drinking water from otherwise clean sources. Both magnify exposure to bacteria species associated with gastrointestinal infections. In the tropical savanna, climate change is increasing risk of droughts, and in the humid subtropical zones, it increases the risk of floods. With climate change, the risks are amplified because of the lack of clean water. The bottom line is, as climate change increases the risk and severity of certain extreme weather events, public health interventions could reduce rising exposure to diarrheal diseases for children in developing countries. Diarrheal diseases are preventable with public health interventions such as immunization, hygiene practices, access to water, and sanitization, all of which should be constructed with climate hazards in mind, Dimitrova said. And in another interesting connection between climate and health, this from Yale University, insect loss stunting fruit and vegetable production, leading to more than 400,000 early deaths a year. The global decline of bees and other pollinators is stunting yields of fruits, vegetables, and nuts. Scientists estimate that the loss of these nutritious foods is leading to 427,000 early deaths a year. This study shows that doing too little to help pollinators did not just harm nature, but human health as well, said Matthew Smith, a researcher at the Harvard School of Public Health and lead author of the study. Rising temperatures, widespread use of pesticides, and habitat loss are fueling a downturn in the population of insects, which has dropped by nearly half in some parts of the world. Insects pollinate around 3/4 of crops, scientists said, and their decline has hurt the growth of key foods. For the study, researchers gathered data from hundreds of experimental farms in Asia, Africa, Europe, and South America, finding that in 2020, growers produced 3-5% less fruits, vegetables, and nuts than they would have in a world with thriving insect populations. But in lower-income countries, the impact was more severe, with the loss of pollinators stunting agricultural incomes by an estimated 10 to 30%. So once again, the most vulnerable are the most vulnerable. Well, let's get to some good climate change news. This from CNN. The ozone layer is on track to recover within decades as harmful chemicals are phased out, scientists report. In rare good news for the planet, Earth's ozone layer is on track to recover completely within decades as ozone-depleting chemicals are phased out across the world, according to a new United Nations-backed assessment. The ozone layer protects the planet from harmful ultraviolet rays. But since the late 1980s, scientists have sounded the alarm about a hole in the shield caused by ozone-depleting substances called chlorofluorocarbons, dubbed CFCs, often found in refrigerators, aerosols, and solvents. International cooperation helps stem the damage. The use of CFCs has decreased 99% since the Montreal Protocol went into force in 1989, which began to phase out of those and other ozone-harming chemicals, according to assessment of panels of experts published last Monday. If global policies stay in place, the ozone layer is expected to recover to 1980 levels by 2040 for most of the world, the assessment found. For polar areas, the time frame for recovery is longer, 2045 over the Arctic and 2066 over the Antarctic. Ozone action set a precedent for climate action. Our success in phasing out ozone-eating chemicals shows us what can and must be done as a matter of urgency to transition away from fossil fuels, reduce greenhouse gases, and so limit temperature increases. Ozone-depleting gases are also potent greenhouse gases, and without a ban, the world could have seen an additional warming of up to 1 degree Celsius, according to a 2021 study in the journal Nature. So it's a good news story that if we do get strong international cooperation, we can make a profound difference. Let's do it. Okay, well, I'm going to close my regular reporting this episode on something you do more for your personal health. This from CNBC. Using this 4-part prescription to wake up alert and refreshed every morning. Over 60% of Americans hardly ever wake up feeling energized or rested, according to a 2020 survey conducted by Restore Z. But not all hope is lost, because there are behaviors that can increase your alertness in the morning and keep you alert for the rest of the day, according to Raphael Vallet, a postdoctoral researcher at the Center for Human Sleep Science at UC Berkeley. Vallet recently co-authored a Nature Communications study that observed certain habits that can improve energy after a night's sleep. The 4-part prescription for increased alertness after a night's sleep? 1. Engaging in physical activity the day before. The higher the amount of physical activity, the more awake and alert you feel the next morning. 2. Sleeping longer and or later than you typically do. In other words, just get an extra 30 minutes of sleep. 3. Eating a breakfast high in low glycemic carbohydrates like whole bread, oats, and brown rice, while avoiding high glycemic carbohydrates like potatoes, white rice, and white bread. 4. Avoiding breakfast meals high in sugar or that include an excessive amount of protein, which can reduce alertness. There are additional factors that may contribute to feeling energized when you wake up. The four-part prescription above details behaviors that are very easy to implement, but there were non-behavior related factors that were associated with alertness after a night's sleep as well, said Vallet. Age. How old a person was actually had a substantial effect on how alert they felt throughout the day. Age is not really something you can do anything about, he says, but we found out is that the older you are, the more alert you feel. Happiness. Mood and happiness also end up being fairly important for feeling energized after waking up. Most surprisingly in the study, we found a super strong correlation between how alert you feel and how happy you rate yourselves. Genes. To investigate the influence of genetics, the study included several sets of identical twins who share 100% of their genomes. There was a 25% contribution of their genes to the differences in alertness between individuals, which fits with something that I've noted over the years as a biologist. The whole question about nature versus nurture, it looked like you're typically talking about maybe 25 or 30% is actually in our genes, and the rest of it is environment and nurture, human culture. Okay, well, now we come to the bonus round of the show. Bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you a link at the end of the list. I have 12 bonus articles this week. First up, let's go big. The U.S. could help solve its poverty problem with a universal basic income. A little surprisingly coming from Scientific American. Glad they're tackling such issues. Bonus article 2, one from Ohio. Citizen scientists are seeing an influx of microplastics in the Ohio River. So you've got a bunch of citizens who are out there monitoring, counting the amount of small plastic particles in the river, and they've increased a lot recently. Way to lead the way. Article 3, Forever Chemicals Expose the Need for Systemic Changes. This is a good overview of a lot of things I've reported in the past about how chemical regulation, which is usually done around individual chemicals, and also is where the chemicals are kind of innocent until proven guilty, rather than a precautionary principle, which would be you got to prove that it's safe before you start piling it up into the environment. And for a longer read and an example, a more specific example about how this plays out, bonus article 4 is why EPA's long-awaited proposal on two forever chemicals is bound to be controversial. A good read. Bonus article 5, scientists are finding increasing evidence for a link between air pollution and neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. So we've known for a long time, of course, that air pollution is bad, but we're having a very quickly fast-growing body of evidence about the specific links to a wide range of health problems from air pollution. And a little more bringing this home, bonus article 6, too many smelly candles? Here's how scents impact the air quality in your home. Air quality in a home can often be two or three times as bad as the outside air, depending on your home. And smelly candles and other aromas and stuff can add a whole lot of these volatile organic compounds, which are a big source of indoor air pollution. And a follow-up to a previous story that I've reported on, bonus article 7. Consumer Product Safety Agency Chair and White House say there are no plans to ban gas stoves. So last week and weeks before, I've reported on stories talking about how gas stoves in the home are a big source of indoor air pollution and increase asthma and all kinds of stuff. And there was some talk about even the potential of banning, but man, when that news hit, they made it very clear, regulators did, that they're going to go for voluntary improvements. Yeah, well, hopefully that'll work, but usually it's just a long, long delay when that fails before you actually get some regulation with teeth. Okay, well, in another regulatory front, bonus article 8, Federal Trade Commission's proposed ban on non-compete agreements could be a game changer for some physicians. So you might have heard that they're talking about getting rid of non-compete agreements among all workers, which is really big. But this, for a lot of physicians, could be really big because physicians who are often forced to sign these non-compete agreements, basically, if they leave an employer, they pretty much can't get a job in the community that they're in. So they have to, like, leave. So it's very disruptive to healthcare and to those particular physicians. So a good thing for them. Bonus Article 9. For addiction treatment, longer is better, but insurance companies usually cut it short. So this is another good example of where there's not parity between mental health and physical health, which was supposed to be taken care of over a decade ago with some legislation, but in reality, it doesn't happen. Bonus Article 10. Senator Bernie Sanders to target high health care costs as leader of influential committee. So as he takes over the important, powerful health committee, look out. And this article will give you an overview of things he's looking at addressing. And a very interesting article, bonus article 11, Maryland Attorney General seeks to preserve massive set of sexual assault evidence. So there's one physician who's kept over years and years a whole set of sexual assault evidence. And they've already solved 80 cold cases based on this evidence, but they have another 1,800 cases that they have evidence on that's not been analyzed, but it's subject to being destroyed. So the Attorney General's trying to prevent that from being destroyed so it continue to be used for law enforcement. And last but not least, bonus article 12, antipsychotic withdrawal, an unrecognized and misdiagnosed problem. So this is something that if you're on an antipsychotic and you stop taking it, you often experience withdrawal, but healthcare providers will often tell you, oh, that's because you're no longer taking the medication and your disease is coming back, when in fact, a lot of times it's just withdrawal. And this is true for more than just antipsychotics. It's true for antidepressants and other mental health treatment, drug treatments as well. So something to keep out in mind for you and your loved ones. You can view any and all of these articles or listen or re-listen to this show or other shows by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That is toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-